I'm going to apologize right up front for telling the corniest joke ever. I tried to find something else, but this one was just too perfect, so bear with me. Here goes. Once there was a little boy who lived in the country. They had to use an outhouse for a facility, and the little boy absolutely hated the outhouse because it was always hot in the summer and cold in the winter, and it stunk all the time. So the little boy decided that because the outhouse was on the bank by a creek, he could push the outhouse into the water. And after a spring rain, when the creek was fully swollen, the boy knew it was time. So he got a running start, and he lowered his shoulder, and he rammed it into that outhouse and watched it as it toppled into the creek and floated away. Later that night, the little boy's dad said, "Son, let's you and I take a little trip to the woodshed." And the little boy knew that meant a spanking. He asked his father, "Why?" And the father said, "Because someone pushed the outhouse into the creek today, and I think it was you, wasn't it, son?" The boy answered, "Yes, it was, Dad." And then the little boy thought for just a moment, and he said, "Dad, today I read in school that when George Washington cut down the cherry tree, he didn't get into trouble with his dad because he told the truth." The father responded, "Well, yes, son, but George Washington's father wasn't in that cherry tree." That's the worst of it, I promise. There are four things I think we can learn from this, and I'm only going to talk about three of them. I'm going to use the story of David, King David, and one of his adventures to make these points in a more dignified manner than my story did. But here's the three points: that we don't always do the things that we should do. In fact, we very often do things that we shouldn't do. And secondly, that we often want to compare what we've done to what others have done, especially if it's bad, so that we can say ours wasn't that bad. And then third, there are consequences to our actions that we're not always aware of. So I'm going to be sharing this story from the book of 2 Samuel. It's all of verses 11 and 12, but I can't include all that. This is long anyway, but the story is fascinating, and I really suggest that you get out your Bibles when you get home and look at 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12 and read the whole thing, and you will thank me for that, I think. Point one: we do things we shouldn't do. From 2 Samuel. In the spring of the year, when kings normally go out to war, David sent Joab and the Israelite army to fight the Ammonites. They destroyed the Ammonite army and laid siege to the city of Rabbah. However, David stayed behind in Jerusalem. Late one afternoon, after his midday rest, David got out of bed and was walking on the roof of the palace. And as he looked out over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Then David sent messengers to get her, and when she came to the palace, he slept with her. Then she returned home. Later, when Bathsheba discovered that she was pregnant, she sent David a message saying, "I'm pregnant." Then David sent word to Joab in the field, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent him to David. When Uriah arrived, David asked him how Joab and the army were getting along and how the war was progressing. Then he told Uriah, "Go on home and relax. You see, David needed Uriah to believe that the child Bathsheba was carrying was his own, so he sent Uriah home. But Uriah didn't go home. He slept that night at the palace entrance with the king's palace guard. Well, when David heard that Uriah had not gone home, he summoned him and asked, "What's the matter? Why didn't you go home last night after being away for so long?" Uriah replied, "The ark of the Lord and the armies of Israel and Judah are living in tents, and Joab and my master's men are camping in the open fields. How could I go home to wine and dine and sleep with my wife? I swear I would never do such a thing." Isn't it a terrible thing when you are totally acting without integrity and your nemesis has it in spades? Yeah. "Well," David said, "stay here today, and tomorrow you may return to the army." So Uriah stayed in Jerusalem that day and the next, and David invited him to dinner and got him drunk. But even then, he couldn't get Uriah to go home to his wife. Again, Uriah slept at the palace entrance with the king's palace guard. So, the next morning, David wrote a letter to his field general, Joab, and gave it to Uriah to deliver. The letter instructed Joab, "Station Uriah on the front lines where the battle is fiercest. Then pull your army back so that he will be killed." So Joab assigned Uriah to a spot close to the city wall where he knew the enemy's strongest men were fighting. And when the enemy soldiers came out of the city to fight, Uriah the Hittite was killed, along with several other Israelite soldiers. Then Joab sent a battle report to David. He told his messenger, "Report all the news of the battle to the king, and then tell him Uriah the Hittite was killed too." So the messenger went to Jerusalem and gave a complete report to David. He ended saying, "Some of the king's men were killed, and Uriah the Hittite was killed too." This part kills me. "Well, tell Joab not to be discouraged," David said. "The sword devours this one today and that one tomorrow. Fight harder next time and conquer the city." Pretty despicable, right? Yeah, we do bad things. We do bad things. Okay, second, we compare what we've done to others. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. And when the period of mourning was over, David sent for her and brought her to the palace, and she became one of his wives. She gave birth to a son. But the Lord was displeased with what David had done. Now, listen carefully. This is the part of the story I bet many of you know. So the Lord sent Nathan the prophet to tell David this story. There were two men in a certain town. One was rich and one was poor. The rich man owned a great many sheep and cattle. The poor man owned nothing but one little lamb he had bought. He raised that little lamb. It grew up with his children. It ate from the man's own plate and drank from his cup. He cuddled it in his arms like a baby daughter. One day, a guest arrived at the home of the rich man. But instead of killing an animal from his own flock or herd, he took the poor man's lamb and killed it and prepared it for his guest. Now here comes the righteous indignation. David was furious. "As surely as the Lord lives," he vowed, "any man who would do such a thing deserves to die. He must repay four lambs to the poor man for the one he stole and for having no pity. Wonder if David was thinking, at least I'm not as bad as that guy. Here's where it gets real. Nathan said to David, you are that man. The Lord, the God of Israel, says, I anointed you king of Israel and saved you from the power of Saul. I gave you your master's house and his wives and the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. And if that had not been enough, I would have given you much, much more. Why then have you despised the word of the Lord and done this horrible deed? For you have murdered Uriah the Hittite with the sword. Notice that they haven't even mentioned Bathsheba. Our scriptures, written and curated by men, don't even see her as an injured party in all of this. It's just Uriah. From this time on, your family will live by the sword because you have despised me by taking Uriah's wife to be your own. We do bad things. And when we do bad things, there are consequences. And often we're not even aware of all the consequences, the way they spread. Now here's point four. And I'm not going to spell it out for you. Just listen. Then David confessed, I have sinned against the Lord. Nathan replied, yes, but the Lord has forgiven you, and you won't die for this sin. Nevertheless, because you have shown utter contempt for the word of the Lord by doing this, your child will die. After Nathan returned to his home, the Lord sent a deadly illness to the child of David and Uriah's wife. David begged God to spare the child. He went without food and lay all night on the bare ground. The elders of his household pleaded with him to get up and eat with them, but he refused. And I want to stop here for a minute and say, I do not believe at all that this child's illness is a punishment for David's sin. I believe this is people trying to explain why a child died and attributing it to God, because not knowing means not having any control. Not knowing means being at the mercy of whatever powers killed the child, and means it could happen again. So I think they were trying to make sense of this. Then on the seventh day, the child died. David's advisors were afraid to tell him. He wouldn't listen to reason while the child was ill, they said. What drastic thing will he do when we tell him the child is dead? And when David saw them whispering, he realized what had happened. Is the child dead? He asked. Yes, they replied, he is dead. Then David got up from the ground, washed himself, put on clean clothes. He went to the tabernacle and he worshiped God. And after that, he returned to the palace and he ate and he drank. And his advisors were amazed. I might say they were righteously indignant. Listen, we don't understand you, they told him. While the child was still living, you wept and refused to eat. But now that the child is dead, you have stopped your mourning and you're eating again. See, now they're the indignant ones because they know the way this should work. And David replied, I fasted and wept while the child was alive. For I said, perhaps the Lord will be gracious to me and let the child live. But why should I fast when he is dead? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him one day, but he cannot return to me. That David comes across as a pretty despicable guy in this story, doesn't he? I mean, bad. Not just a bad plan, but a bad plan that's foiled, and so he creates another plan and another plan. And he keeps acting badly. David, The man after God's own heart. Jesus Christ, Son of David, born in the city of David. David is one that God loves. How can that be when he's so bad? Well, David accepts the truth about his actions. And he asks for forgiveness. And he trusts that it is granted to him. John Hawk says, "The forgiveness of God is marked for sinners only. That's the good news that keeps me going every day. I say to myself, I am a sinner, I am imperfect, I make mistakes. I do some things right, I do some things wrong. Therefore, I am one whom Christ can save." Hawk continues by saying, "What better news could there be for any human being? Once you experience that forgiveness, the I have paid it all for you-ness of Christ on the cross, you can be freed from the paralysis of perfectionism." That's where I hope we live. Not in that moment of indignation that David had, but in that moment of, I need forgiveness. I've asked for forgiveness. I have received forgiveness. I'm going to finish with one more story. This comes from one of my favorite preachers, Will Willimon. He's former dean of Duke Divinity School. And I think people love him for just his realness, his authenticity, his folksiness almost. So this is a story that he shared one time. And I'm going to share it with you. It was Saturday night. There was a knock at Will Willimon's door. Willimon opened the door to find a policeman standing there on the doorstep. "Preacher," he said, "could you come with me? Some of your church members have gotten into a big brawl, and the chief thinks you might be able to help us settle them down." Don't y'all ever do that to me. Willimon was aghast. Some of his church members? How could this be? He got in the officer's car and went a couple of miles into town. This is the first thing he heard when he got out of the car. "Now cut out that shooting, Joe. And you two settle down and come on out. You're going to hurt somebody if you ain't careful," blared the chief of police's voice across the debris-strewn yard. Willimon looked around and he could see broken glass and overturned furniture, some inside, some outside of the house. It was an apocalyptic vision, he said, of chaos and battle. A shot rang out from inside the house. The chief ducked down behind his car. "This is no place for a man of the cloth," Willimon thought, as he inched his way over toward the chief's car. "How are you doing, Reverend?" the chief asked amicably as Willimon joined him in his improvised bunker. "Well, not at all well at the moment," the preacher said. Joe and his wife are having a little argument, it seems. It's gotten a bit rough, and we thought that maybe you could help us settle this down, preacher," said the chief. "A little argument," said Willimon in amazement. "Oh yeah, they have one of these every spring." "You mean to tell me this has happened before?" "Oh sure, it's not all that big a deal. They just seem to let things build up during the winter and then every spring they let it all out, so to speak." Willimon was appalled. And to think this was one of his best church members. After 5 or 10 minutes in which no shots or cursing had come from the house, and after several attempts by the chief to elicit some response from Joe and his wife, the chief pronounced that they probably passed out now. It's safe to go in after them. Williman accompanied the police into the scene of the heart of the battle, where they found Joe and his wife, just as the chief had predicted, passed out on their living room sofa, a bit bruised, scratched up here and there, but apparently in surprisingly good condition for two battle-weary veterans. By that time, neighbors had begun to arrive, and they were helping to clean up the debris and helping the two groggy combatants into their bed. The chief led his men back to their cars, saying something like, "Well, that ought to hold them till next year." As for Williman, he was shocked, disappointed, angry, but mainly he was embarrassed. He returned home that Saturday night, determined to relieve Joe of his church duties as soon as possible. Was this any way for one of his members to act? The next morning, in the quietness and beauty of the sanctuary, the disorder of the evening seemed far away. As Williman moved through the worship service, he had hardly given Saturday night's episode another thought until it came to the offering. The preacher dutifully got the offering plates and turned to hand them to the head usher. And who should be the head usher on that Sunday morning? Joe. Williman says, "I nearly passed out when I turned around and saw Joe standing there, smiling sheepishly, bandages on his bruised hands, a cut under his eye, more or less reverently waiting for me to hand him the offering plates. Joe stood there before me, before God, before the congregation. This was more than I could take," Williman said. "The nerve of that man, had he no pride? Had he no self-respect? Can you imagine someone having the nerve to stand up before the altar on Sunday morning after a Saturday night like that?" "No, Joe," Williman thought, "I would not have been caught dead up there on the altar before God and all the righteous people on that Sunday morning after what you did on Saturday night." "You see," Williman says, "I'm too good for that kind of imprudence in worship. It's bad form. When I behave that way, I keep my distance. I have too much pride to bear bandaged and still bleeding wounds before the altar, smiling sheepishly, holding out my bruised knuckles as if I had come here expecting to be given some gift. Unlike you, Joe, I have my pride." He has his pride and his righteous indignation, neither of which are God's plan for us. Now, don't think for a moment that I take domestic abuse or this scene lightly. I'm not condoning it in any way. But I wanted you to get it. Not some nice story of not returning the extra change as you go through the drive-through line or something like that, but I wanted you to really get it. In our life of faith before God, there is no place for pride and righteous indignation. Righteous indignation always goes wrong. Pride and righteous indignation, neither are God's plan for us. What is God's plan for us? Grace and mercy. It's not just God's plan for us. It's God's plan for everyone. Grace and mercy. It should come not only from God, but from each one of us too. Amen.